For the Pacifica Radio Network and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schock. On October 1st, 2015, Oregon joined Washington and Colorado as the third state to legalize recreational use of cannabis. Now that it is easy as going to one of the many cannabis shops in the state and choosing from a wide selection of strains, many who perhaps haven't used cannabis since college or are curious and using it for the first time may have many questions about the plant. Many misconceptions about cannabis abound. It is much maligned and misunderstood. Today, we will address questions such as, what are its effects? What's a good dosage? Why do some people have negative experiences with it, such as paranoia or anxiety? Is it addictive? Is it good for society to legalize cannabis? We will address those questions in this episode of Progressive Spirit, but we're going to go further. We're also going to talk about the spirituality of cannabis. How can cannabis be an ally in spiritual practice? My guest is Stephen Gray. Stephen Gray is a teacher and writer on spiritual subjects and sacramental medicines. He's worked extensively with Tibetan Buddhism, the Native American Church, and with entheogenic medicines. The author of Returning to Sacred World, a Spiritual Toolkit for the Emerging Reality. He's also a conference and workshop organizer, leader, and speaker, as well as a part-time photographer and music composer under the artist name Kiri. He lives in Vancouver, British Columbia. He's written a new book that we will discuss today, Cannabis and Spirituality, an Explorer's Guide to an Ancient Plant Spirit Ally. From Vancouver, British Columbia via Skype, welcome, Stephen, to Progressive Spirit.
Thank you, John.
Tell me about this book, Cannabis and Spirituality. How did it come to be?
Well, I've been involved with entheogens or psychedelics in one fashion or another and spiritual work for a long time. One of the things that led to, I have a previous book from 2010 called Returning to Sacred World, and that introduced me to a whole new bunch of people. And I got involved in organizing a conference here called the Spirit Plant Medicine Conference. And that led me to meeting Kathleen Harrison. Do you know who that is, John?
No, tell me about Kathleen Harrison.
Well, you know who Terrence McKenna is, right?
Tell me about him, too.
Okay. Terrence McKenna was and still is to a large degree famous and maybe even a little bit infamous as a spokesperson, a philosopher of psychedelics and such like. Anyway, I just thought maybe you know who that is. Kathleen was married to him for quite a while. She's an ethnobotanist and a really wise and knowledgeable person. And she and I were talking, and I told her that I felt that while cannabis was spreading rapidly in a variety of ways, you know, medically, legally, recreationally, etc., I was aware that there is an ancient and widespread use of this plant as a spiritual medicine that was not being addressed, really, as far as I could see. It seemed like it was getting short shrift. And so I mentioned this to Kat, that I was vaguely thinking of, you know, putting a book together, but I didn't think I had a whole book of information in me to do it. And she said, well, you know, I think that would be a really important book. And if you write it or you do it, I'll contribute to it. And I've seen writing by her, and she's a beautiful writer, and as I say, very wise and insightful soul. And so that was a turning point for me. I thought, geez, if Kathleen Harrison will, you know, contribute to it, I'm going for it. And so I ended up getting a total of, counting me, 18 contributors to the book. And again, the purpose is to address this sort of oversight, I suppose you could say, and you know, remind people sort of early in the book. I have a chapter by a well-known scholar on the history of cannabis and ritual and religion, Chris Bennett, just to remind people that it does indeed have a thousands-year-old history of spiritual use on this planet in many locations throughout Asia, Europe, and Africa in particular, and more recently in the Americas. And then just talking about some ways that you can use it, that way, some attitudes and so on that will help, you know, improve your chances of cannabis being a beneficial spiritual ally.
You used a word there, entheogen. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's a synonym for psychedelics. excuse me, psychedelics. Actually, the term it's a Greek word, I believe, that means mind manifesting or manifesting the mind, and it's actually an accurate description of a number of substances in the days when it was a popular term. Particularly tended to refer to LSD in the 1960s and early 70s and so on, but it also could apply to psilocybin mushrooms, ayahuasca, peyote, and a number of other substances. In 1979, one of the researchers coined the word entheogen as a replacement, because psychedelics is such a sloppy word, you know, in mm-hmm. cultural usage. Although that baggage has largely receded at this time, we're so far away from that now. But still, I prefer the word entheogens myself, and it's another, I think, Greek word that means entheo, or theo meaning God, and en meaning in, and gen meaning like generating. So it's generating the divine within. Which is a slightly narrower term than mind manifesting, but definitely points at the what you might call the highest potential of these plant spirit medicines. And cannabis has straddles the line there. It's generally considered a much milder substance, although it can be extremely powerful. And I do like to lump it into the entheogenic category for that reason.
Let's talk about that specifically. How does cannabis do this? How does it mind manifest? How does it bring a spiritual awakening to the user?
Right. It's a relationship between you and the plant, as it were. You know, one of the things I think is a little bit, there's a bit of a misunderstanding in our culture about substances in general of any kind. You know, sort of like almost like they're commodities, you know, that they're fixed commodities. The people who know these plants, including cannabis, really well, understand that it is a relationship, and that there is some sort of a spirit or an energy in the plant, or that can be brought through using that plant with the right attitude, with the right kind of practice. There's a term, set and setting, which is typically or often applied to the use of these so-called major entheogens that I've referred to. And set meaning everything that you bring to it, your short and long-term history, emotional history, psychological history, your attitude about the substance and the encounter, everything that you bring to that. And setting is the actual environment in which you take it. And indigenous people have been using these kind of substances for thousands of years, and they understand that really well, especially setting. They understand that there are things that can happen when there is a safe, effective container guided by people with great experience, knowledge, and wisdom. They can open up spiritual wisdom in ways that would not happen otherwise. You know, if you take psilocybin mushrooms at a party or something like that, there's a very little chance that you're going to have any idea what that can do when it's done in a skillful ritual context. Cannabis is more forgiving in general than some of these other major entheogens, but it can make a big difference when you're talking about using the plant for spiritual benefit. So your question, how does that work? Well, there's different ways to talk about it. One of the chapters in the book is by Joan Bellow, and she talks about what you might call the pharmacokinetics of the plant, which is how a substance or drug enters, the process by which it, you know, comes into your organism, your body, how it's processed within the body, and how it's expelled or released. And the way Joan talks about it, there's other ways to talk about it as well, but the way Joan talks about it is that we're talking about smoking and vaporizing in particular, as opposed to oral ingestion, which comes on obviously far, far slower. But when you smoke or vaporize cannabis, the effect is pretty much immediate. And what happens is there's a bit of an increase in the heart rate. So the heart's working a little bit harder. It's pumping freshly oxygenated blood throughout the organism. It's also been referred to by some researchers as a vasodilator, dilator. And it's also referred to as a homeostatic balancer. So the way Joan Bellow talks about it is that it neither stimulates nor depresses. It balances those two functions together and creates a kind of a balance. And so what happens with this increase in heart rate is that there's an, as I said, an increase of blood flow into the all sections of the organism. I wouldn't say always, because if you resist the plant or, you know, or complicate it with other drugs or whatever, not necessarily going to happen. But in the best circumstances, the skeletal muscles relax, breathing becomes deeper and more slower, and the whole system is energized in a balanced way. A simple way that I like to refer to cannabis is as a non-specific amplifier. This is a term that's applied to these major entheogens. They, in a sense, they're a gift of energy, and it depends on how you channel that energy. So, as a benefit in your spiritual work, cannabis can be an adjunct or a supporter of a variety of practices, meditation, yoga, and so on. Because if you can channel that energy, if you can stay very present, if you can dissolve the thoughts that obscure what's going on to some degree, that's sort of a basic spiritual teaching, a Buddhist teaching, you know, that our thoughts, what they call discursive thoughts, are the what you might call the ego's primary strategy for obscuring unconditioned reality. So if you think of cannabis as a non-specific amplifier, then with intention, with some kind of skill, discipline, focus, you can deepen your practice. You can deepen your meditation. You can deepen your yoga practice, etc. And then also, as Joan Bellow points out, it's not just about the momentary, temporary experience. Obviously, the high wears off in a couple hours if you're smoking or vaporizing. But again, sort of referencing Joan Bellow's way of talking about it, it's an accumulative process over years, really, you know, because cannabis allows you to enter more deeply into the now, that can become an ingrained way of being in the world. Like the way I like to think of it is, learning, of course, cannabis isn't necessary to do this. It's just an aid. But learning to trust the immediate felt, perceived experience of now, of the moment, you know, trust your body, trust your intuition, trust your emotions, as this opening process that I talked about can open up the heart. You know, in the most ideal circumstances, it can actually allow us to sort of sink down into a state of nowness, of peace even, you know?
Stephen Gray is my guest. If you're just joining us on Progressive Spirit, he's the editor of the book Cannabis and Spirituality, an Explorer's Guide to an Ancient Plant Spirit Ally. And you've talked earlier about how this has gone through ancient times, that many people have used cannabis as an ally. They already have a spiritual practice, but cannabis is a tool to heighten it, to deepen, to amplify it. Is that right?
Correct, yes.
And also, cannabis is used to inspire creativity. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, in the same way that I just referred to, the kind of the process that works. Again, if you're able to channel the energy, creativity is sort of a little bit of a sidebar to some extent to my main focus with having put this book together, although it's not completely separate from spiritual work. In fact, you could say that maybe what you could say is that the true creativity is spiritual work, you know, that you're connecting to the spirit, you're connecting to the muse or whatever. Cannabis seems to open up other channels of insight and understanding. And again, I used the term vasodilator a little while ago. I know one person who's an extremely good writer. I won't use his name, but he's an award-winning journalist and an author of two or three fairly successful nonfiction books. He's sort of a friend. He's a colleague, I guess. And I asked him, he always writes under the influence of cannabis. And I asked him, why do you do that? And he said, it's a vasodilator. It opens up the channels a little bit, you know, it allows him to focus in a little more deeply and gives him insights and ways of thinking about things that hadn't occurred to him before. There's an interview in the book with two medicine shamans. The title is something like that of that chapter. They use cannabis in their ceremony leaders. They work with entheogenic medicines and lead group ceremonies, like weekend long kind of things. And they use cannabis for that work because, as his name is Steve Dyer, says, it opens up a window and allows him to look into areas that he wouldn't otherwise notice. He can see the energies in the room. He can see what's going on with the participants at another level that he wasn't aware of previously or that he wouldn't normally be aware of. So that sort of ties into creativity. Basically, it kind of allows you, again, to deepen your focus. You know, you can potentially make a stronger connection with the focus of your attention.
I want to talk with you a little bit about experiences that people might have with cannabis. Now that it has become legal, I think people are going back to it. They may have tried it, for example, years ago in parties or whatever, and it may have had a negative impact, paranoia or having just all these negative thoughts and whatnot. How might people use cannabis more wisely to have some better experiences?
Yeah, well, it's with that kind of discipline focus I was mentioning, John. The thing about cannabis, if you think of it as an amplifier, it can potentially amplify everything. So if you're there's a few ways to talk about this. It can make you more vulnerable, you know, because it's potentially softening up the system and knocking you out of your sort of standard status quo state, right? Mm-hmm. If you're not ready for that, if you're not open to that, that can be difficult. It can cause some self-examination that not everyone is happy to do. Using a Buddhist way of talking about it, the ego is this kind of package we've put together to survive with, you know, it's very conditional. Like we're happier when things are going our way and less happy when things aren't going our way. If we get knocked off our game, you know, I'm sorry to have to drag Donald Trump into this, but I would say he's a classic example of someone whose whole existence is based on ego. And, you know, you can just see that with his sensitivity about any kind of criticism, right? Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't want anybody to knock him off his game. So awakening, so to speak, ultimately the enlightenment stage, I guess you could say, is where you're not knocked off. There is no game to knock you off. You're just relaxed, open-hearted, confident in an unconditional way. So people who have trouble with cannabis haven't liked it oftentimes, you know, when there's no kind of discipline focus that way to work with the energy, is that it can amplify your thinking process, and your thinking process can be highly problematic, of course, right? So that's, I think, where the paranoia comes in. That in itself is a topic that can be discussed longer, but the simple way of putting it is that, there's this vulnerability that comes up. There's this sort of truth serum quality that comes up. And, you see things maybe that you hadn't really noticed before that are sensitive about what, you know, who you are, what's going on in your interactions and so on. And that can be really upsetting for a lot of people. I think it's really important to use cannabis well, is to, in the same way that you for people that are meditators, and when I say meditators, I mean the most simple kinds of follow the breath type meditation, which is really the primary purpose, as I understand it, of doing that kind of meditation is to just sort of sit down, remove a lot of external distractions, and allow yourself to see what comes up in your thoughts and release them and recognize this is sort of central to that spiritual process, is that to realize that the thoughts are not you. You don't have to get lost in them. You don't have to take them seriously necessarily. You can just watch them as things that arise that are separate from the sort of essential you and release them, you know, back, come back to the breath or whatever. So with cannabis, those thoughts become heightened. They can become out of perspective. They can become overemphasized or over serious. And if you buy into that, things can be seem to be more dramatic and, you know, more intense. And if they're negative, more problematic. And so I think it's really important to really benefit from this medicine, to be able to, if you're having any kind of negative experiences with thoughts, to just recognize them and let them go. I like to think of cannabis as an energy medicine. It works best, in a sense, when you can get out of your own way. Let your thoughts dissolve for at least part of the time. That's a challenge. It was a challenge with just basic meditation, period, of course. But it is an advanced spiritual medicine in that sense that can allow you to enter more deeply into the present.
You've had 18 different contributors to this volume. Any of those 18 surprised you, giving you some new information that you'd like to share?
Let me see. I love Kathleen Harrison's chapter. It's called "Who Is She?" I'm not sure if it's completely new information for me, but she has some very interesting things to say about how one develops a relationship with cannabis. She likes to, as an ally in that sense, she talks about how you need to treat it with respect and reverence, almost as if you're inviting an honored guest into your home. She also has some very interesting things to say, and this is a theme that comes up in the book here and there by several of the contributors, is, as I was saying, there's ways, of course, that cannabis is not a benefit to people. And Kathleen Harrison really nails that one. There's a page or two in her chapter where she talks about, cannabis is very seductive for a lot of people. It can enter you into regardless of, you're not thinking spiritually or anything. People like the feeling, they like that kind of sweet feeling that they often get from it. And a lot of people, as Kathleen points out, she noticed this. She's been around a lot of people. She teaches a lot, does workshops and seminars and field classes and so on with universities. And she has noticed that young men in particular that she's been around have this tendency to not want to come back out of that space, that they find it a kind of a safe space that they've carved out for themselves. And that can be really problematic because people can get wedded. I think that's her word, actually, wedded to that sort of state. And it can become primary. They can prioritize that over their connection to the, Kathleen's term, daylight world of responsibility and relationship. That's a very interesting thing to be aware of, the seductive quality.
So there is an aspect of an addictive, would that word be correct in this sense too?
Yeah, I use that, or I address that issue. I have a chapter myself I put at the end of the book called Cautions, Obstacles, and so on, and Sidetracks. And I explore this addiction versus dependency issue a little bit. Addiction is a little bit tricky because it depends on how you use it. Sort of scientifically or medically speaking, or physiologically speaking, cannabis's addictive qualities are minimal. They're at about the same level of coffee, as witnessed by gazillions of people who have gone cold turkey on cannabis. Like it's one day they decided, hey, that's enough, and they've maybe been using it heavily, in their teens or early 20s or whatever. And you know, universal reportage on that is that nobody seems to have any long-lasting or, I mean, intense withdrawal effects. Maybe a few days of, you know, their patterns being thrown off, a little bit of irritation, sleep patterns changing or something, and then it sort of settles out pretty quickly. You know, as it compared to something like, you know, heroin or even alcohol, which is extremely difficult to get off and has intense withdrawal symptoms. So the physiological element doesn't quite qualify as addiction, but perhaps more importantly, the psychological addiction or dependence factor is definitely a problem for a lot of people. Cannabis is kind of a gracious, almost neutral substance or ally in a sense that, again, whatever your intention is, it will intensify it. It will enhance or deepen, take you farther down whatever road you're already pointing down. So if your intention is in your life is to escape and avoid connection, you know, cannabis can take you there too. So that all comes back down to this simple idea of like, well, simple conceptually of what is your intention with the plant, you know, set and setting. How do you use it? What is your intention? And if your intention is to soften, to open up, to relax, to be present, to open your heart, to deepen your meditation practice, it can help as an amplifier.
I'm speaking with Stephen Gray. He's edited a fascinating book, Cannabis and Spirituality, an Explorer's Guide to an Ancient Plant Spirit Ally. We've talked about doing it, cannabis, using cannabis as a spiritual ally individually. How do you see it happening within a group of people?
Interesting thing to think about. Basically, group work with meditation, for example, can be a powerful thing to do. There's something about doing something like that with a group. There's a combined energy, a focus, a discipline that can happen when you're with a group of people. I've done a lot of meditation over the years with groups and alone. And, you know, when you're sitting in a room with people and there's, you know, somebody has started the, you know, the session and you know that an hour later or 2 hours or 3 hours later, they're going to end it, or at 45 minutes, they're going to give you a little ding and you're going to get up and do walking meditation. Then you just relax into that state and everyone else around you is doing it. So you're not going to suddenly get the idea that you got to go phone your friend 25 minutes in, right? Mm-hmm. So there's soul discipline and this kind of intangible energy, perhaps, that comes from, a collective group focus. The other thing about being in a group is that if someone's leading the group, it doesn't have to be that way with cannabis, I don't think, but I think it can be really helpful to have someone leading the group who knows how to work with the plant and also can be kind of like the conductor, as it were, so that the rest of the people don't have to think about anything like how long I've been sitting there, am I going to get a break, you know, or whatever. That person can guide things. And there are other things you can do, you know. I've led groups with friends up here, and we meditate in that simple follow the breath way, but I also give them a lot of breaks, bring in a little music, some drumming occasionally. We've had people lead short yoga sessions in these groups. We do walking meditation and a few other things, group om chanting, that sort of thing. The simplest, purest, most direct and with the most potential way of meeting cannabis in these ways to be just, in a sense, doing nothing, like, you know, just being there, meditating. That doesn't have to be sitting still. It could be walking in the woods, for example. You know, the reason that great traditions like Buddhism have sitting meditation is because it removes all other focuses of attention. You don't have to think about where your foot's going next, you know, if you're walking, for example, right? You're just sitting there. It's a sort of a pure connection to the present moment. So in a sense, meditation is the sort of the primary or, you know, in a purest or simplest way to meet presence, meet spirit in a sense. And so I call that the wellspring as well. So if you can bring yourself back, whether it's in a group setting or just by yourself, if you can, even if you're, you know, playing some music or, you know, doing some yoga practice, if you can bring yourself back to just sort of clear, non-thought, more or less, mind, occasionally sort of drop back into the wellspring, I think that has perhaps the greatest potential.
Cannabis in the United States particularly has been a much maligned drug, illegal, finally becoming legal first as medicine and then for recreational use in a few states, including Oregon. What do you see some obstacles to this positive change, and how do you think we can make cannabis a more respectable plant or more respectable as understood?
Oh, well, I guess the simple word is education, you know, and that's what the book is all about, you know, trying to educate people that this is a spiritual plant. It's, you know, I can't answer that question. I can't do justice to that question in a couple of minutes, really. But I will say, not only as a spiritual ally, but for many, many purposes, this plant has an ancient and widespread history. It is very simpatico with our chemistry and our interwoven into the life of people for a very long time. And it deserves to be legal for adults in particular, of course. And it just has potential to be used wisely in ways that most people who aren't familiar with it or haven't studied it at all don't realize. So it's overcoming prejudices, old standing prejudices, etc., education.
As one of the authors said in the book, that it human beings have really co-evolved with cannabis.
Yeah, well, the lineage it comes from is estimated to be between 30 and 90 million years old. And, you know, to the best of our record-keeping abilities, we know that at least in China, who are reasonably good about that sort of thing, its use culturally goes back 10,000 years or so. Odds are it's much older than that. We don't have much record beyond about 12,000 years ago on this planet. We have evidence from grave sites of the shamans in the Neolithic era, 7,500 years ago or so, of cannabis residue, that they were clearly using it as a spiritual ally. It's been around. And just again, briefly, we have this system in our bodies called the endocannabinoid system, the interior cannabinoid system. We're loaded with cannabis or cannabinoids, actually, cannabinoid receptors, to be more specific. So cannabis itself is an exocannabinoid that we can introduce into our bodies. It meets these multitude of receptors throughout the brain and the nervous system and other areas of the body. It's non-toxic. It has no what's called LD50, the lethal dose at which 50% of people would die. There is no LD50 for cannabis. The singer-songwriter Willie Nelson said the only way cannabis would kill you is if a bale of it fell on your head. So it is very simpatico, both culturally and chemically with human beings.
I know the worst thing about cannabis is the prison sentence that goes with it.
Yes, indeed. So, yes, I think it's going to change. You know, it just needs more people to educate more people. I would like to see more people use cannabis with some sort of discipline so that, you know, that the kind of negative experiences or reasons why people would, you know, set it aside or not feel. You know, Joan Bellows says, you know, that it makes things bigger, more expansive, but more unpredictable. And if you're overly identified, I guess you could say overly identified with things as they are, you don't want to change, you don't want to be opened up, you don't want to learn, you don't have an open mind that way. You're really addicted to your ego as it is. Cannabis can threaten that, and people won't like that. A lot of people won't like that. But that's a lot of that is in thought. So even those people, if they're willing, anyone who's willing to work with cannabis this way, if they can give it some calm, relaxed setting to work with it and, you know, not take those kind of thoughts seriously, but learn, I don't know how easy this is for any particular human being, but learn to let the thoughts calm down and just really pay attention to the energy of the plant. It's a very healing plant. The physical, medical healing benefits are not separate from its spiritual benefits in the way it opens up and moves energy, allows energy to move more freely in the system. One way of talking about sort of where we are in general as a culture or as cultures these days is there's an imbalance toward the masculine yang type way of being, as it were. We need, for spiritual awakening, we need to tune into more receptive qualities, which are often associated as being feminine qualities, receptivity, surrender, surrendering this sort of package of the ego we've put together and relaxing into it, tends to be associated with a receptive yin type quality. Kathleen Harrison addresses that a little, as do a couple of the other contributors to the book.
When you mentioned Trump earlier, I mean, you talked definitely about this yang. Alcohol, for example, would be that. We are definitely alcohol-influenced society, but this would be a better balance, wouldn't it?
I would say so, absolutely. You know, it's interesting that, you know, one could probably write a whole book about this, I suppose, that alcohol is the one sanctioned substance, you know, intoxicant or mind-altering substance, and it is the least mind-manifesting, the least psychedelic of them all, in a sense, right? Mm. It numbs. That people like it because it, you know, reduces their inhibitions, but it sort of reduces their inhibitions by stupefying them, right?
Right.
You know, I mean, it's, if you sit somebody down and do any kind of test with them after a drink or two or three, they perform more poorly. It just sort of shuts down a lot of things, which allows people to sort of relax a little more, but it's not with awareness. Whereas cannabis and the other entheogens are sort of the opposite. You can relax with cannabis, by becoming, in a sense, more aware, more present. And as you say, alcohol has this aggressive sort of quality about it oftentimes. Two of the contributors talk about, combining cannabis with other, entheogenic medicines, that it can support those in the same way that it can enhance and support, certain spiritual practices. But this one particular person talked about, he said, he's an ayahuasca shaman from Brazil, actually, and he works with both ayahuasca and cannabis as a spiritual medicine that he calls Santa Maria, Saint Mary. But he said that the 20th century was the alcohol century, and the 21st century is going to be the cannabis century, or the Santa Maria century.
What would you suggest if somebody is coming and wants to try cannabis again, and the importance of, how much to take?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a repeated theme in the book as well, which is less is more. And that can refer to both the specific dosage in that moment and the frequency of use. You know, that's a bit of a complicated topic because a lot of people can benefit from daily use of cannabis. Again, it comes down to how you're using it. You know, if you're not using it to escape, if it's not numbing you out from your connection to people and work and so on and so on, some people find that because of this homeostatic balancing quality that cannabis is an effective way for them to be in a good space. And we're talking about lighter dosages generally there. And in fact, if you use it that often, the effects are softened or even, you might say, dulled anyway. And so for that reason, I and other contributors to the book talk about frequency. If you really want to explore cannabis for deeper spiritual work, it seems to be important to do it less frequently because of this familiarization, tolerance kind of effect that it has. But also less is more could mean, you know, especially if you're not really used to it and if you're trying to apply it, you know, to some sort of disciplined approach, probably good to start with a small dosage. You know, the cannabis, much of the cannabis these days is so strong, as we know, right? The THC content is very high in a lot of cannabis now. Starting small. And basically what I sometimes like to say is the optimal dosage for spiritual work is the dosage that you both want to and can handle in the sense of being able to stay present and not be lost in your thoughts or, discombobulated in some fashion or another, you know. On the other hand, if you can handle it and you keep it real simple, you don't start mucking with machines or anything, you know, and you just do meditation or yoga, a stronger dose can take you deeper, obviously. So there is that. And the strains come into it as well. The sativas tend to be more, sativa-leaning strains tend to be more energizing and up. The indica ones tend to be more soporific, drowsy-inducing. People have to experiment for themselves. Some people prefer for meditative-type work to have it be more of a sativa-dominant strain because of the energizing quality, sharper quality. Other people may find the sativas to be, they can't really handle the amount of sort of generation of energy and thought that keeps, pounding at their door with sativas and prefer the potentially more calming effects of indica, whereas the sativa crowd, so to speak, finds oftentimes the indicas to be a little too dull or not as sharp, you know. So there's all that as well.
An excellent book, Cannabis and Spirituality, an Explorer's Guide to an Ancient Plant Spirit Ally, edited by Stephen Gray, and he has a number of chapters in the book as well. Stephen Gray, thank you for this book, and thanks for spending time with me today.
Thank you, John.
I wrote a letter to the Oregonian that was published on April 7th. It was in regard to the shooting death of Quanis Hayes by Portland police officer Andrew Hurst. Quanis Hayes was the 17-year-old who was shot three times by Officer Hurst by an AR-15 rifle from about 15 feet. According to Officer Hurst, he believed, but by his own admission, did not see that Quanis had a gun. He shot him because he thought he saw his hands moving to his waist to retrieve a weapon. After Quanis was killed, the police discovered a replica gun 3 feet behind him. The grand jury did not indict Officer Hurst. Before that grand jury decision had been made, I had spoken with Venus Hayes, Quanis's mother, and Teresa Rayford of Don't Shoot Portland, and that was on a previous episode of Progressive Spirit. This is what I wrote in my letter to the editor. I like Portland. I like it enough to call it out on its racism. Redemption is possible. Portland, I've heard, is the place where young people go to retire, unless they are black. The black young people end up being targeted and profiled by police. It is no surprise, but a preventable tragedy, that Quanis Hayes was killed by Portland police officer Andrew Hurst. I spoke to Quanis's mother. I read the grand jury transcript. I'm not satisfied. Regardless of the justifications offered by the police, the outcome is clear. A kneeling, unarmed, 17-year-old child was killed by a bullet to the head and two to the chest. Whatever this child might have done that night, and however scared the officer might have been of him, there is no justification for this. While the police may have thought Quanis was a threat, it is more likely that racism got the better of the officer and he panicked. That is no surprise. Portland has a long, violent history of racism. If Portland is going to change outcomes and rid itself of the cancer of racism, concrete actions need to be taken. First, there needs to be a federal investigation into this case. Second, we need a special prosecutor, not a grand jury, when police use fatal force. Third, we need to end profiling. Fourth, police need body cameras. Portland can do better. We're all in this together. John Chuck Beaverton. I was mostly vilified in the comment section by readers who called me a moron and who said things like, quote, thank you, Portland police, for eliminating a violent armed thug. And what do you call two to the chest, one to the head? Good shooting. I recorded an interview with Dr. Michael Eric Dyson about his book, Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. I'm going to air a few portions of it on this show and then the full interview on a later episode. I asked Dr. Dyson about the killing of Quanis Hayes. I asked him to explain police brutality against African Americans, the fear defense that is used by white police when they kill African Americans, and the unwillingness of the authorities, including the police, to accept the humanity of African Americans. Tell me about policing, if you would. I'm here in Portland. We had a young man here, Quanis Hayes, 17-year-old. He was shot by police. Do you know about that story? Can you say anything about the level of police and violence and young people dying at the hands of police? And
I mean,
prejudice is involved in that.
Here's an example of the extraordinary difficulty that black people have in convincing white people that this is a reality that we confront. You know, that police brutality is real, that the inability of black people to convince white people that this is a reality that must be confronted, that, you know, that it's a reality that many white brothers and sisters don't have because the police don't treat them the same way. And that, you know, when we look at what happens to Quanis Hayes, that, you know, the grand jury there, I think, ruled that the shooting was justified. How many times do we have to hear that unarmed black people it's a justification for killing them, that it is all right to kill them, that it's acceptable, it's legal to kill them, that there is little defense we have in the system of law in this country and of criminal justice to be able to support and sustain us as we argue that our lives should make a difference, that they matter. Time and again, and this is what I address in my book, police brutality rises up in America and makes a mockery of the justice system, makes a mockery of who we are as human beings. It makes a mockery of us as American citizens who should be protected by the law and not made more vulnerable by that law. And so it is difficult for a police person to be brought to justice in our criminal justice system. Grand juries often will not indict a police officer in the commission of a crime. And when they do, as they did with the police officer down in South Carolina, who killed Walter Scott on tape, unbeknownst to him, or should I say on recording, and shot him in the back 8 times, a white juror said, "I just couldn't do it. I couldn't convict him." And so this is how white privilege operates. Even when we have clear and ample empirical evidence of the commission of a crime, often white officers will not be held accountable in killing often unarmed black or brown people. So this is the kind of you know, lunacy according to many black people, and the paradox according to me and many white people that we live in. Lunacy because we keep saying it and we keep having to prove that it's true, and no matter how much we do it, it's there. Paradox because, you know, many white people say, well, look, you know, we live in a culture where black people commit most of the crime, and therefore most of the crime is not, ironically or paradoxically enough, involving black people being killed by white police officers. It's black on black crime. And of course, you know, it is true that 93% of black people who are murdered by black people, but 84% of white people who are murdered by white people. There's no white on white crime. There's no paradigm established where white people are held to account or demonized in a similar fashion or seen as worthy of other deaths, because the majority of deaths will come through their killing of each other. We don't do this when the opiate addiction. Oh, my God, why are you worried about the opiate addiction? Why are you worried about white people dying from heroin and the like? Most of you are dying at your own hands, so stop it. We don't see that. But when black people say the police are killing us, oh, well, forget that. Most of you are being killed by your own. Well, many of you are, you know, as much as the heroin addiction exists, most of you are not dying by heroin. You're dying at the hands of other white people who murder you. That's the kind of insult that black people have to live with constantly. And it's the kind of refusal to acknowledge the situation in which we live and the complicity of white culture and a criminal justice system that is often insensitive to us.
And all of this is also related to just this internal fear that people have of the other. I mean, it's in the case, again, back to Quanis Hayes, shot by an AR-15 rifle 15 feet away, once in the head, twice in the torso, because the police officer believed he had a weapon, but didn't see it, admitted in his own self that he didn't see a weapon. God, all of these cops around him were so in danger. What is that?
That is the fear of black masculinity, the fear of black personhood, the fear of black femininity, the fear of black people. Why do you roll up on Tamir Rice and within 2 seconds shoot him dead in Cleveland? Because there was a report of somebody wielding a gun and the like. And he's a 12-year-old kid playing in the park, but he doesn't get the benefit of the doubt. Why? Because he's a black male. He looks older than he is. A report was released a few years ago suggesting that black kids are denied their childhood. They look older to white people than they are. Therefore, they look like adults. And the irony is many black children are treated as adults, as men, if they're male children, and many men and women are treated as children by the same criminally unjust and racist American system. So Barack Obama was treated like a black child to many, and Tamir Rice was exaggerated as a black man. Both are discarded and disposable. And when we think about the Hayes situation in Portland, when we think about Michael Brown in Ferguson, it charged me. The police officer reduced Michael Brown to a thing, to an it. You know, Martin Buber talked about ich und du, I and thou. And what Dr. King talked about, the thingification of our society, making things out of people. And so black people are the boogeyman, the perennial, preternatural, perpetual boogeyman to many white people. The collective white unconscious sees black people as inherently threatening. And black masculinity and black femininity, female identity is somehow threatening, that black people represent something dangerous and provocative that must be contained and corralled and ultimately eliminated and terminated. And so this is what you're dealing with, the collective belief about their essential and enduring harm and trauma to the culture, and an enduring trauma and harm to the culture that must be relieved, must be resisted, and finally, must be eradicated.
Again, going back to the Qantas Hayes situation and realizing how much effort was put out to not be able to have Qantas Hayes be seen as a human being.
Oh, yes. I mean, this is the constant worry that black people have, the threat that we are seen as a menace. And the moment a charge is against us, we have to be perfect victims. White folk can have DUIs, go to jail 10 times. You're still my child. You're still my neighbor. You're still my person, my son, my daughter, my husband, my wife. They have their humanity preserved amidst their frailty and fragility. Black people have to be perfect, and even then, they are targets. Barack Obama had committed no crime except that he existed as a black man. No crime except that he was black and president. No crime except he was president while black. And Donald Trump and other birthers, millions of them, denied his humanity, his legitimacy as a president, saw him as somehow un-American. Mitch McConnell had as his major, if you will, goal to make him a one-term president. The hypocrisy, the moral and the ethical, if you will, erosion of integrity that is manifest when it comes to relations between black and white people, the mistrust, the distrust, the mistreatment. So yes, we have to see black people as human to begin with. And when we do that, then we will stop some of the evil practices and some of the unjust realities that flow in our criminal justice system, more broadly in American society and in our relations between each other.
That's Michael Eric Dyson on Progressive Spirit, author of Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America. Progressive Spirit is heard every week on several radio stations across the country. 60 Minutes of Smart. Progressive Spirit is now in its sixth year and is now an hour long. On Progressive Spirit, you hear interviews with cutting-edge scholars, authors, and activists who have something to say about social justice, human flourishing, and things that matter. If you enjoy the show, ask your local public radio station to check it out and consider adding Progressive Spirit to its weekly lineup. Progressive Spirit is formatted for radio and is distributed through Public Radio Exchange, PRX, and the Pacifica Radio Network. You can also catch Progressive Spirit on podcast. Hear it on your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear and listen on iTunes or Stitcher or any app that has a place for a review, please leave one. More reviews help the show get a wider audience. If you have ideas for guests or would like to comment on an episode, contact me through my website, progressivespirit.net. You can comment on Facebook and retweet on Twitter. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm John Schack. Be well.